Today's Dharma talk will be on case 12 in the Wumongkan, the Wumenquan, the gateless gate, gateless barrier. Zwigan calls his master. Zwigan Gen Osho called to himself every day, "Master," and answered, "Yes, sir." Then he would say, "Be wide awake," and answer, "Yes, yes, sir." Henceforth, never be deceived by others. "No, I won't." Woman's comment. Old Zwigan buys and sells himself. He takes out a lot of God masks and devil masks and puts them on and plays with them. What for, eh? One calling and the other answering. One wide awake, the other saying he will never be deceived. If you stick to any of them, you will be a failure. If you imitate Zwigan, you will play the fox. Woman's verse. Clinging to the deluded way of consciousness, students of the way do not realize truth, the seed of birth and death through endless eons. The fool calls it the true original self. So we should all be feeling pretty good now. After a whole morning or a half morning of sitting, which is such a gift, just sitting here, taking one breath after another, letting go of everything that has gone on during the week, or even this morning on the way, just sitting quietly for two periods or five periods. I love morning sitting. I always have. I'm a morning person. I do much better sitting in the morning than I do at any other time. Maybe you were able to go into really deep mushin this morning, somebody. Or maybe not. Maybe you had to spend your time working through something that happened during the week. That's just as good in some ways. It's very important. That was kind of where I was coming from this morning. But whichever way you do that, Saturday morning sitting is just wonderful. And I think I wonder sometimes how Sashin might be different for the some of us if we didn't have these sits every week, every other week. Every week, actually, we do long sitting on every Saturday, but this one, two of them are longer than the others. But how would Sashin be different for us? Because I think most of us who have come here probably go to weekday sits at one place or another. We hopefully have sitting practice at home. Maybe not every day if we can't, but as many days as we can for as long as we can. Even 20 minutes, 25 minutes is a help. And I used to really enjoy coming. For a long time, I think, I used to come in the morning to Rutgers, sometimes during the week, and meet with Brian and Jeff. I remember those sits very vividly. I really love that. And I always went away feeling better, feeling like I could, was better prepared for the day. But sitting during the week is different from sitting on Saturday morning. I mean, you're basically doing the same things. You're breathing, you're working with Mu or your koan, but it's for a shorter period. And this is more, actually this Saturday morning is in some ways more intense than even Sesshin in the morning. Because when we're on Sesshin, for those of you who've never been, we do get up very early, but we have breaks. We don't sit for longer than about three periods in the morning, maybe three and a half. And then we have a two-hour break before the next two. So to be able to come here and sit from 7 until noon is really great. It's really wonderful when you can do it. Actually, the morning sits, weekday morning sits, I used to think, gave me a sense of mindfulness during the day. A lot of times I would go away, maybe the thoughts would flood in again, but I would find myself during the day just stopping. This was not at the very beginning when I first started Zen, but after a while I would, and even to this day it goes on, where it's I'll be driving along and I'll stop for a light and I'll just stop and I'll just really look at where I am, really focus. I mean, maybe a light change is 30 seconds, maybe it's even a minute sometimes, but for those, that short time, I'll pay attention to my breath. And a lot of times it feels like my brain had a little vacation for a few seconds. It feels really good. Or I'll just become really aware of my body, my foot on the pedal, on the steering wheel. Sometimes everything just totally relaxes and it's almost like every cell in my body responds for a few seconds. And then as soon as the light changes, it's back to driving, which is good. You wouldn't want to be trying to go into deep samadhi while you're driving, for sure. But just at those times when you have to be still anyway, there's so many times during the day when that happens, when it's just a very short time. And in the beginning, you might not even think it's worth the slight effort. But you know what? It is. It makes a difference. I had one of the people I write to in prison that I've been writing to for a couple of years now. That's practically his whole practice because that's all he can do. He has to get up before anybody else in the morning to get even like 20 minutes of sitting in. That's the most he can do during the day. And people don't realize what noise-filled places prisons are. But they are so noisy. But he's written many times how he'll just do basically what I told you. Just stop. Just pay attention. Just be mindful for whatever short little period of time he can. And you know, it shows up in his letters. His letters are so clear and thoughtful. It amazes me sometimes what people like that, incarcerated people, some of them can do with no teacher, nobody to sit with, and actually not even hardly any way to sit quietly. And the progress that they do make on their own is amazing sometimes. So I think, you know, mindfulness is something that throughout the day is something that can come can come from these morning sits, sitting by yourself in the house, which maybe doesn't feel like you're doing anything. Or if you can sit with another person, that's even better. I used to, years ago, before Zen, I didn't know anything about any of this. But I realize now, even back into the 80s, something in me was looking for silent places. And one of the things I really liked to do, once my boys got to be in an age where I could leave them for short periods, was to volunteer. That always appealed to me as an adult. Finding different ways to volunteer time. For one thing, if you're not getting paid, that's a lot less stress. Really, the expectations are not the same. You can offer, and most of the time, whoever you're volunteering for will be more than happy for whatever time you can give. Sometimes there's a little bit of structure around a process, like when I used to volunteer in my parish, I guess they still must do it. Homeless people go from parish to parish, and each parish takes its turn. But I would always go for the middle of the night. I would always go for the shift that would arrive at like 10 o'clock at night and interact with people for a little while and then get them settled and tucked in and then go to sleep and get up in the morning and help them out with breakfast. For some reason, those late night hours were my favorite, despite the fact that I'm a morning person. Go figure. But that's what I liked. And I mean, there were other ways I tried volunteering, different things I tried doing. But the best thing that I came across was the helpline. And the helpline that I learned about and ultimately became part of was Contact We Care. We have two other of our members who, one of them is very active on this helpline, Sharon. The other one, Nyla Farr, and her husband, they have a child now, so they no longer are, but years ago, they went there, they found out about it, they went there, they took the course, which is an excellent course, 16 weeks, and it was in the telephone room that they saw on the bulletin board the little leaflet for Rutgers meditation, and that was how they learned about our Zen program. But that helpline was something really special for me. I volunteered for them for 20 years, and again, most of the time, I would go for the all-night shift. I mean, I was a lot younger then. I don't think I could do that now. But I would arrive. At that time, it was in a Presbyterian church in Westfield, a big, huge church with a very tall steeple. And when I would arrive there at 11 o'clock, I had to go through a special door. I was the only one in that building. Now, my husband is beginning to wonder about my sanity at this point, because I seem to be disappearing in the middle of the night, and that seems to be my thing. But there was something about walking through that door and going into that big, empty building with not another person, and all the way at the back was our telephone room. And I would sit there, and that's what I would do, is wait during the night for the phone to ring. I also did shifts during the day, and I have to say this is really interesting volunteering. I really liked interacting with all the different types of callers who called, and there were so many, and we were trained so well to be ready for almost anything. The basis of our training was empathy. They taught us to listen but with empathy to people. And they used to say to us, you will hear stories on this phone that you could never in 100 million years relate to, even a little bit. But if you can figure out what feeling that person is experiencing, that's where the empathy will come in. It has nothing to do with the story. It's the feeling. There's a million stories. There's only really relatively few feelings. Some of the callers really did call. Everybody waited for that wonderful call that would come. One out of, 10 calls would be somebody who really wanted help, support. We were facilitators. We were not supposed to solve anybody's problem, but just help them solve their own problem. And there were people that really called like that. But many people couldn't feel their feelings. They couldn't know what they're feeling. They had so many feelings going on at the same time that the help you would provide would be to try to just get them to realize what feeling is bothering them the most right now. And that's probably as far as you could get with them. Which was good. It was progress. But then there were those who used us, who would call. They would call them really stuck people. Good chance that nothing is ever going to change in this life for them. But they would call, and you would give them a little time anyway. And I remember one lady who, she would call about the same time every day. And she was not a middle-of-the-night caller. So it was when I was doing like a morning shift or something. So even if a male telephone worker happened to be on duty, she would just hang up. She wouldn't talk to him at all. And we all knew it was her because it was the same time every day. But if it was a woman on the phone, she would talk to you. And the conversation was always exactly the same. It never changed. We all knew what was coming. We all knew it. And we all would work to try to veer away from, to help her to veer away from where she was headed. But it never worked. It never did. We always had to just wait for the question. The same question every time she called. And the question was, are you married? She would ask that to every female telephone worker who she would talk to. If you said yes, she'd pause for a minute, then she'd start hollering at you. She'd start yelling. You're married. What am I talking to you for? What a waste of time this is. What a horrible telephone worker you are. You're married? How could you help me? You found a man. You don't know what I'm going through. I can't find a man, and I'm trying to explain to you. But what could you do to help me? Bang, the phone would hang up. Fine. If you said, no, I'm not married, same thing. She'd start hollering at you. You're not married. What am I talking to you for? This is a waste of time. You can't get a man either. Bang. Every day. Same phone call. Everybody waited. We all knew. And we all really, really tried. We tried to help her. We would do things as the conversation began to kind of try to get her off in a different direction. It never worked. Now, can you imagine living your whole life like that? And there was so many people like that. So many. Some people had us on speed dial. They would list all the phone numbers of all the different, I don't even to this day don't know exactly how speed dial works, but I know we knew this happened. So that was part of it. But that's not usually what happened in the middle of the night. And What happened to me, not every call, but sometimes in the middle of the night, was really worth going there, was really worth staying awake. I'm thinking of one woman in particular, a younger woman who lived with her parents. They cared for her. And she was psychotic. I think it was schizophrenia. I don't remember. This was way back in the 80s. But she would call, and she knew how to dial. She knew how to dial us, and she knew certain things. But she would call, and you would spend time on the phone with her in a conversation that would make absolutely no sense to anybody. She would talk to you. She would tell you stories about little people that visited her, you know, all the typical things that come out of a person who has mentally is kind of shattered. But she was not afraid, whereas a lot of people like that would call terrified because something was chasing them, or she was not afraid at all. She was warm, she was friendly, she really enjoyed talking to people, and even though what she said didn't make sense, on some level, I hope I can explain this right, on some level, we reached each other in a very deep way. Any kind of work like this with phones means that you have nothing to connect you with people but their voice. The voice is all you have. You don't even really have a name most of the time because they make a name up, or, you know, they don't tell you. All you have is this voice, and that's all they have of you. So this is like I'm sitting there at maybe 2 in the morning or 3 in the morning in this big empty building. There's no way I could think of it at the time, but this is almost like a Zen experience. The building is empty. You're the only person there. Everything has fallen away. Everything has left you. Whatever happened, you know, before you got there is gone. You're in the room with a phone and this voice. And something between us would take effect. I like to call it now TW Samadhi. That's kind of the best way I can describe it. But it was listening to her make no sense and seeing yourself somehow. You know, after a while, just seeing yourself there. I don't know how else to say it. And actually, sometimes I would hear her smiling at me. And I think probably she had a similar experience because of the way she responded. Something connected through all of that illness that went so far beyond it and so much deeper. And it would go back and forth, and it was like, you know, it was like, yes, Master, be wide awake. It was something like that. That's the best way I can put it. And it's what kept me going there for 20 years. I would just keep going, and there were others like that, but her I remember most vividly. So I now, looking back, have two ways of looking at empathy with people. I have the way I was taught on the helpline, which is actually standing in another's shoes. I think we've all heard that expression. Just knowing what is happening with another person and being able to look into yourself and find something that in your past story that was similar, or the feeling, really the feeling. If somebody calls you psychotic and terrified, you can't be psychotic and terrified, but you can think of something that terrified you, and that's good enough. There's that kind of empathy. But I also feel there's something even deeper with certain people that I tried to explain just now, and it goes beyond just standing in others' shoes. It becomes like recognizing yourself, almost like looking in a mirror. It's like sitting in a room with someone you know really well and talking to them with your eyes closed, and that can start you in the direction and give you that first kind of empathy. But I don't know what happens that brings you to the second place. It's like discovering yourself. That's the best way I can say it. So empathy, I think, is it's true, it is like one of the most important things in life, and it's something that many people in this culture or in any culture, for whatever reason, don't have. And I mean, if we look at what goes on in the world, we can probably point to that many times. I know the Buddha said that the three poisons are greed, hatred, and ignorance. And, I mean, some people even say greed and hatred are really nothing more than ignorance. And what is ignorance anyway? I think it's a lot of maybe different things that I'm sure volumes have been written about it, but in many, many, many cases, it's the absence of empathy, of any kind of empathy. That's what I've come to believe about it. And it can cause a little bit of trouble, or it can cause horrific things to happen. But it's not always somebody deciding to do something bad. It's unconscious, and it's just a wall there that people can't see each other, can't look in the mirror. They can't look in the mirror. I finished a book ignorance, I think, or absence of empathy is maybe not all, but it's really at the bottom of a lot of our life koans. A lot of the situations in our life that we have no explanation for, that we grapple with, that we struggle with, that we can't see any way that we created this or caused this to happen. And of course, you know, koans are really these stories that stop us from thinking. I think that's one of the functions of a koan. It's to stop your thought process dead in its tracks, because there's nothing you can think about it. And life koans can be kind of like that too. I just really finished a book this week, a wonderful, wonderful book. And the name of it is The Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down. And it's written by a woman named Ann Fadiman. It's a story of a little girl, but really it's a story of a whole culture, and it's the story of our culture. Maybe 3,000 years ago, a group of people, at least that's as far as they can be traced back, and maybe some of you have heard of these people. I never heard of them until I read this book, the Hmong people. Hmong. They have lived for probably 3,000 years, and they think, according to this author, they think that they originated in southern China. But they have lived in every one of those countries, Laos, Vietnam, all of those countries over there. They are farmers. They are nomads. The reason why they're nomads is that every place they've lived, they've been persecuted. They are a rich culture that has some beautiful, beautiful traditions. Very, very child-oriented. They love their children. And according to this author, in many ways, their parenting is probably better than some of our parenting. That's her opinion. But they, anyway, they live often, well, in the countries that they lived for all those years, at the top of mountains. They would deliberately go there so that they could be self-sufficient, and they did not have to mix, they did not have to blend with any other culture. They were rigidly embedded in their traditions, to the point where they really wanted no part of any others. And it was, and a feisty group of people, and would often get into wars and things with the cultures around them. They would stay to the top of the mountain, and then in the valleys would be all the powerful people that had all the answers and ran everything and had all the affluence and power and everything. But they would just stay up away, and they would farm. They would they had a very complicated or spirituality, a very detailed, ritual-oriented spirituality that revolved to a large extent around the soul of a person, how that soul comes into the body, what has to happen to it while it is in the body, when it leaves the body. Very, very important things they had to do, rituals, a lot of animal sacrifice, which I had trouble getting through, but kindly animal sacrifice, I have to say, and nowhere near what happens in our culture in slaughterhouses. And they would talk to their animals, they would tell them why they would thank them for giving their souls up. So, and they would quickly and cleanly kill them as sacrifices. If people in the family were sick, they would, that's one way that they would deal with it. They had shamans, a lot of mystical beliefs. So in July of 1982, a family, many people came to this country, many Hmong people came to this country and settled in California. These were people that were involved with the Vietnam War and Laos and were used by our CIA, and that's a whole part of the story that's really interesting. I had no idea when I was living through that era that all of this was going on, but anyway, this one family came and settled. And not able to read or write, not able to speak a word of English, 13 children and one on the way. The little girl was born in July, and it was the first time, first of all the children, that she was born in a hospital, which was a very strange experience for her mother, but she tolerated it. And then what happened was 3 months later, when the baby was 3 months old, her sister slammed a door going out or doing something, and the baby's eyes rolled up, and she had her first seizure. Her parents saw this happen, and there was no question in their mind what had just happened. It was clear. It was totally clear to them that the door slamming had frightened her soul, and her soul had left her body. So they just waited. They had gone through a whole ceremony to welcome her soul into her body when she was born. They waited to see, and she had many seizures before they actually brought her to the ER. Now, the Hmong people, many of their shamans have seizure disorders. So there's a double way of looking at this. There's always concern when it's a baby because they know it's, in a way, she's sick. But on the other hand, she also has this special connection with the spiritual world. So it's almost like a wonderful thing in some respects and an awful thing in others. So finally they did bring her to the ER. She had several trips. Then they began bringing her every time it would happen. But by the time she would get there, the seizure would be over. So the doctors would look at her, no translators. The doctors would look at her, examine her, and find that she had pneumonia because of the secretions in her lungs because of the seizure, put her on an antibiotic and send her home. Now, this was Merced County Medical Center was supposedly at that time a state of the art medical center. Residents wanted to get there from every part of the country. They had the best doctors. Over the next 3 or 4 years, this went on. And this is where the culture clash really set in. It was a back and forth kind of thing. Finally someone, they got her in there when she was actually having a seizure. And so someone realized she became the patient of two of the best doctors in the hospital. But it was really a terrible struggle over this period of time until she was about 4 or 5 years old, because the parents had such a set idea of what was happening to her. They could not understand the doctors. They could not follow the instructions. They could, even when you could get through to them, they didn't trust the medicine. So without going into every detail about this story, the doctors suffered terribly because they became emotionally involved with the child. Everybody involved became so, had to struggle so deeply with this reality and try to connect, and no connection could be made for a long, long time. They were non-compliant with the medication, mostly because they didn't understand it, but even when they did, sometimes they would lie and say they had given it to her and they hadn't, and then they would go home and, you know, perform a ceremony and hope she would get better. Finally, she was removed from the house. That just made things worse because then she was grieving. Parents were grieving. Everybody involved, it just snowballed. And nothing seemed to be able to make it better. Finally, she, because of all the medications that they had put her on, she had a terrible, terrible seizure. But it wasn't, and they assumed it was from her condition, but it wasn't. It was because she had developed an infection from her lowered immune system. A Pseudomonas is the name of the bacteria or the organism. And from that point on, she became, she went into a vegetative state. Ultimately, that's how she ended up. With the best doctors in the country working to help all the time, with loving parents that could not have loved her more if they tried. Her mother, when she was 35 or 40 pounds old, was carrying her around in a pouch on her back, sleeping with her. It's just a very moving story of a tragedy where everyone involved deeply loves or cares about this baby, and everything they do just makes everything worse and worse and worse. There could be no empathy between them. Nothing like that could develop, except for a few. There were a few people involved that did. She had foster parents that really worked with her and worked with the family and actually became friends with the family. But in between this is the story of the people as a whole, of them coming from other countries, and it's just a wonderful book, but very sad. She's now in her late 20s. At a number of times she was on the point of death. The parents were all ready. They put her in her funeral clothes. The doctors took her off all her medications, and she continued living as a vegetable. She's now in her late 20s, and she's still alive, and she's still living with her parents. So I guess my reason for talking about all this is to talk about empathy and talk about how difficult it is, how really, really difficult it is for people sometimes. And this book was written with no blame really placed anywhere. The author went and spent hours and days and weeks and months interviewing everybody, looking through 5 volumes of medical records. And there was just no solution, no ending. It was a mega life koan that is still going on. In the end, the family has the child, and they perform an animal sacrifice, and they call out the door to her soul, and to this day, that's what they believe is true, that her soul is gone. And it was just I don't know how to end this. It's just a series of happenings, of occurrences, of events that happen. I mean, it's an extreme case, but this is the kind of thing that we go through in life. That many times life is not cut and dry. Somebody did something wrong or did something bad or made terrible mistakes. It's like everybody is trying as hard as they can, and tragedy occurs anyway. So in some way, when I read this book, it made me think of this koan. I don't know, I can't explain why, but that was it, and so that's why I'm telling you about it. Maybe when I read the koan again, it'll become a little clearer. Suigan Gen Osho called to himself every day, "Master," and answered, "Yes, sir." Then he would say, "Be wide awake," and answer, "Yes, sir." Henceforth, never be deceived by others. "No, I won't. This whole story is full of trust and mistrust. Mostly mistrust that arose because of not understanding, not discovering that place between you that goes beyond language, goes beyond culture, goes beyond anything that you could point to that would define how people should relate to each other. Old Zwegon buys and sells himself. He takes out a lot of god masks and devil masks and puts them on and plays with them. What for, eh? One calling and the other answering. Everybody trying. Everybody putting on different approaches. Trying different approaches. Everybody trying. Calling each other. Family calling her soul. Calling out for her soul to come back. What for, eh? One calling and the other answering. One wide awake. The other saying he will never be deceived. If you stick to any of them, you will be a failure. If you imitate Zwegon, you will play the fox. If you just stop, and do that often enough, and pay attention, sometimes you can discover that place where you're looking in the mirror. Clinging to the deluded way of consciousness, students of the way do not realize truth. The seed of birth and death through endless eons, the fool calls it the true original self.